Hey, hey, holy mackerel, no doubt about it, the Cubs are on their way. Hey, hey.
The Chicago Cubs are playing a World Series game tonight for the first time in 71 years. In 1993, a Vegas odds maker was asked what the odds were that the team hadn't made a World Series since 1945.
What were the odds of the Cubs avoiding a World Series since 1945? If he had been an odds maker in 1945, you told him the Cubs would not make a World Series for the next 47 years, what would be the odds? He said they'd be astronomical, off the charts, they'd be a million to one.
We'll also hear from longtime Cubs fans about what the wait has been like for them.
My heart's been broken since 1969 when I was 16 years old. And all we have is four more games to win. And hallelujah, the Cubs are on their way.
Want to share your Cubs stories? Tweet us at 21st Show or give us a call at 800-222-9455. That's all coming up on today's 21st. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Moline, filling in once again for Nyla Boodoo. Tonight, the Chicago Cubs play in the World Series for the first time since 1945. Most fans weren't around for that series, and many thought they'd never live to see their lovable losers playing for a World Series title ever again. But tonight, the wait is finally over. All this hour, we'll be talking with Cubs fans, broadcasters, and team historians about tonight's historic game and the Cubs' quest to win their first World Series title since 1908. First, we want to catch up with our regular host, Nyla Boodoo, who's standing outside of Wrigley Field in Chicago with the woman who brought her to her very first Cubs game, Jan Bolick. Nyla, how are you today?
Hey, good morning, Brian. How are you doing?
Doing very well. What's the city of Chicago like today on the morning of the Cubs' first World Series game in 71 years?
I think everyone's just very excited. I think it's all over the city. There are the W flags everywhere. I was downtown this morning. Now I'm up at Wrigley Field. There's lots of people. There are people. Someone just climbed over the barricade at Wrigley Field to take pictures with Ernie Banks. This little kid just went by. And he just was chanting, "Go Cubs, go!" This 3-year-old. So I think everybody's very excited.
As expected, what do you think Wrigleyville, the area right around the ballpark, will be like at game time tonight?
I mean, I think if this weekend is any indication, it's just going to be kind of madness. They've got a lot of barricades set up already. Right now, most of the people who are here are just sort of passerbys and people taking pictures. I imagine as soon as work gets out, like the Cubby Bear, which is just across the street from me, is going to be pretty full. I've heard someone was telling me this morning that some neighborhoods around here, some restaurants are taking reservations for just $500 just to be at a table in Wrigleyville. So just for people to be close by.
Nyla, we understand you have Jan Bolick with you, a season ticket holder who's been going to games for the past 62 years. Why don't we hand the phone over to Jan right now? And Jan, if are you with us?
I'm right here, yes.
How are you feeling today, Jan?
Nervous, and excited as well.
I'm sure. What have the past few days been like for you since the Cubs clinched this World Series berth?
Sleepless. I can't sleep when they win. I can't sleep when they lose. But it's worth every wink of lost sleep.
When did you start going to Cubs games?
When I was in second grade, 7 years old.
Wow. And did you ever think you'd see this moment happen in your lifetime, the Cubs going to the World Series?
No, absolutely not. It's amazing. And then I can check it off my bucket list when they win it.
There you go. I'm curious what Saturday night was like for you. I understand you were at the game with your kids.
I was at the game with my son and daughter-in-law, and it was very, very exciting, and everyone was exuberant and pretty well controlled, I think, for, you know, the excitement of the moment. It was a mob scene outside, but you could get through. The streets weren't blocked like they were last year. So you could go onto the street and get out of the area onto public transportation. But everyone was screaming, "Go Cubs, go, win, win, win." It was so exciting.
And what are you looking forward most to out of the World Series starting tonight?
Oh, just that the Cubs shine and do their best job. You know, it's such a personable team, and that's what's fun to watch. And, of course, Joe Maddon is such a personable guy. They seem to be like a bunch of frat boys enjoying every minute of the season, and particularly the wins during the postseason.
Well, Jan, thank you so much for joining us today on the 21st, and enjoy the World Series.
Yes, and go Cubs!
Go Cubs, indeed. I'm sitting here in the studio wearing my Cubs t-shirt and hat as well. So I share the sentiments with you, Jan. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll talk to more fans coming up in just a bit. But first, we want to catch up with the voice of Cubs pre- and post-game shows on Comcast Sportsnet, David Kaplan. Cap's been a Chicago radio personality since 1995, where he now hosts the Cap & Co. show on ESPN 1000. Hey, Cap, thanks for joining us today on the 21st. I know it's a really busy day for you.
That's my pleasure. Thanks for having me. Sitting here at Progressive Field in the ESPN radio booth looking down on this gorgeous day, and Cubs in the World Series. Can't get a lot better than that.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll get to some analysis of the team in just a minute, but I want to talk to you a little bit about David Kaplan, the fan. What was Saturday night like for that side of you, Cap?
Well, it was amazing. I think by winning the pennant, it put all this Billy Goat curse stuff to bed. It's gone. Billy Goat Kerr said he would not go to a World Series. I never believed in it. I always thought it was a bunch of nonsense. The people that believed it were ridiculous. But now that they're in the World Series, hopefully, win or lose, you go, you know what? We either got beat by a team that played better, or we beat the team that played better, and we played better. One or the other. But for me that night, it was pretty emotional because my dad's gone. And he's the guy that instilled this love of baseball in me and my brother. And for me to be able to be on the field and, you know, hosting Cubs pre-post and then looking up in the sky going, hey, Dad, we made the World Series. That was a pretty, pretty cool moment for me.
I'm sure. I was fortunate enough to be able to actually give my dad a call after Saturday night's game and be able to share that a little bit with him. I know, you know, certainly you would have loved to do the same, but to have that experience, you know, being a Cubs fan from your dad, what's your first memory of him bringing you into the Cubs fandom?
I was a little kid, born in 1960, and I think I was six, maybe seven, and went to a ball game. I think I went when I was a baby, and I don't remember it, but I remember walking into the ballpark, my mom and dad, my brother and I, and my brother's a Sox fan, and so he's already complaining when we're going to Wrigley, and we walk into the stadium, and we walk up the stairs at the top of, like, the second section, and you look down, and I see the ivy and the green grass, and the weather's beautiful, and I'm like, okay, this is the single coolest place I've ever been. And I was hooked. I was bitten by a disease known as Cubs fandom. It's not, there's no cure for it. You don't choose to get it. You just fall in love. It's just like love at first sight. And so I've been a Cub fan since the day I was, you know, laid eyes on them. And I'll be a Cub fan till the day I die, whether I'm in this business or not. And to see my team and to go, I'm at the World Series. I'm broadcasting here and my team is playing, it can't get any better in my career, I'm telling you, unless they win it.
Yeah, Pat Hughes told a story near the end of the Cubs NLCS clinching game on Saturday. He was talking with Billy Williams earlier that day, and Billy said to him, you know, God, I wish my buddies were here. He was referencing late Cubs greats Ron Santo and Ernie Banks. How would those guys, you know, be experiencing this moment if they were still with us?
I mean, Ronnie was very, very close to me. We worked together for, he died in 2010, and I started working on the Cubs broadcast in 95. So I had 15 amazing years with Ron Santo. So I know he's smiling down, but if they were in it, he would be bouncing off the walls. He would be almost insufferable to be around in a good way because he so wanted to see his Cubs in the World Series and to see them win a championship. So, and I knew Ernie, so did a lot of shows with Ernie. I did a show with Ernie shortly before he died. And I know that these two guys would be front and center, you know, leading the parade if the Cubs were to win it, and they would be here in Cleveland, and it would be amazing. But unfortunately, they're not here.
Yeah, it's really too bad, but I'm sure they're looking down and enjoying everything that we're seeing here this week. You know, Cap, you think about all the championships that Chicago's won over the past several decades, you know, the Blackhawks 3 Stanley Cups, the White Sox World Series in 2005, you know, the Bulls with their 6 titles in the 90s, the Bears back in 85. Would a Cubs World Series win rank above all of that?
Oh, if the Cubs were to win a World Series, I truly believe, and I asked Bob Costas this question, and he agreed that if the Cubs were to win the World Series, it would be the biggest sports story probably in the last 50 years in our country, other than the 1980 miracle on ice. That's the only one, because that had political ramifications with, you know, the boycott with Russia and all of that, those overtones. Other than that, I do not think there's a story that is bigger than snapping 108 years of not winning a championship. I think it would be the biggest story we've seen. And I don't think people – look, going into Saturday, I thought we were going to win, and I knew it would be big. It was bigger than I thought it was. To look in the stands and see people crying, holding up signs of departed ones who didn't get to witness it in person. You know, this is for mom. This is for dad. This is for this one. It was bigger than we even thought, and I knew it would be monstrous. And if they were to win the World Series, I'm telling you, cemeteries for weeks on end will be jam-packed with people putting pennants and baseballs and hats and T-shirts and flags and you name it, memorabilia of all kinds, saying, I know you wish you could have been there. It's awesome. We're the champions.
Yeah, the last time, you know, the Cubs came really close to making the World Series was in 2003. You were there covering that team. Yeah, many fans seemed scarred from the way that season ended and seemed to be kind of expecting the worst from the team when they would get into late season scenarios. It seems that maybe things started to switch when last year's team made their run to the postseason, run to the National League Championship Series. Did you sense kind of a change in fans' mindset with the way that this team rose to prominence last season and this season?
Maybe a little bit, but when we were down 2-1 to the Dodgers, or when they were, you know, in a tenuous situation against the Giants this year, the soft part of our fan base unfortunately reared its ugly head, and they were out there on Twitter and all over social media. Here we go. We're going to choke. It's over. We're cursed. It's just some of the stupidest stuff I've ever heard. And look, I'm a Cub fan. I get it. We've been scarred, and the Bartman thing and the Gonzalez boot, the double play in 03, and then losing 98, losing 89, losing 84 in heartbreaking fashion, 69. They don't get there. I get all of that. But you don't lose because a black cat ran on the field. You don't lose because a guy interfered with a ball, make the next play, and they weren't able to do that. I think now, finally, that they have vanquished the Dodgers and they're in the World Series, that the soft Cub fan will go, you know what? That stuff was stupid. Let's just go out and play a baseball game. And if we lose, get up tomorrow and try and win game two. And if you lose, try to win game three. And if you don't win the World Series, it wasn't because you were cursed. It wasn't because of divine intervention. It was because you got outplayed. And if you win it, it's because you outplayed them and they weren't cursed.
I'm curious, as you look at this year's team, and you know, kind of what made them different maybe from some past Cubs contenders, the way that they were built by Theo Epstein and Jed Hoyer. Why do you think this year's team was the one to finally, you know, break through here to the World Series?
I think the experience of last year, as you mentioned, was certainly a huge thing. That these guys have been down this road, maybe not the World Series, but they also have, I think the key to this whole team is they have veterans playing like kids, Ben Zobrist and John Lester and Jake Arrieta, and even though they're in their 30s, they're playing like they're in their 20s, and then you have guys in their 20s, Anthony Rizzo, Chris Bryant, Addison Russell, Javi Baez, and on and on and on, Wilson Contreras. Those guys are playing like wily veterans. So when you have that mix, and then you have guys, Zobrist won the World Series last year with Kansas City. Lester's won 2 World Series. John Lackey's won 2 World Series. David Ross has won World Series. You have guys who have been down this road, been on this stage, and Theo Epstein, Jed Hoyer have won. Joe Maddon's taking the team now, his second one to the World Series. You have guys that can tell you, here's how we handle every moment. There are going to be moments that don't go our way, and there are going to be moments that don't go the Indians' way. You just have to make sure you take care of business and don't let the moment become bigger than you. That's the whole key to this. You make an error, you move on. You don't go, oh, my God, I made an error and they scored 2 runs. No, that's not how you handle this. You watch each game, 1 batter, 1 pitch, 1 out at a time, and you grind, like John Lester said. I'm telling our fan base in the NLCS, you grind along with us. And if pitch 1 is good, we grind into pitch 2. And if it doesn't go our way, we grind into pitch 3. And at the end of the day, you will be exhausted physically, mentally, emotionally, but you hope at the end of the day you're the one hoisting a trophy.
Cleveland, the opponent tonight. You're, of course, at Progressive Field for Game 1 tonight. As you look at the matchups here between the Cubs and Cleveland, what do you think the keys are to this series?
Well, I think, first of all, starting pitching depth goes the Cubs' way. But tonight, Corey Kluber was pitching for the Indians. He's elite. I mean, he may win his second Cy Young. This guy's a big-time arm. He's got really filthy stuff. You have to make sure you don't make mistakes defensively. You've got to control their running game. And you have to be able to put the ball in play against Kluber. He's really, really good. But Cubs have some elite bats that have really heated up as the NLCS ended those last couple games. So I think it's really, really important to get off to a good start offensively. But you, in the first, second, third inning, you got to control their running game by keeping them off base. And if they are on base, John Lester has to keep them reasonably close so that David Ross can gun somebody out or backpick and pick them off of first.
And Cap, just about 30 seconds left here before we let you go, but what's your pick for this series?
I think the Cubs win it in six. I've heard others saying Cubs in five. I'm not hearing a lot other than here in Cleveland picking the Indians, but the Cubs are a prohibitive favorite. They should win this series. I believe they will win this series, but don't sleep on the Tribe. The Indians are really, really good.
David Kaplan hosts the Cubs pregame and postgame shows on Comcast Sportsnet and also hosts the Cap & Co. show on ESPN 1000. Cap, thanks so much for joining us today on the 21st.
Appreciate you having me.
Absolutely. David Kaplan with us here today. And stay tuned. Coming up, we're going to hear from more Cubs fans about their thoughts on this World Series matchup between the Chicago Cubs and the Cleveland Indians, what it means to them to see their squad in the World Series for the first time since 1945. You're listening to the 21st. Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Moline, filling in for Nyla Boodoo. Cubs fans, we want to hear from you. Is there a particular moment, a game, or other experience that's the defining moment for you when you knew that the Cubs were your team? If you'd like to share that story with us or any other thoughts on the Cubs being in the World Series, you can tweet us at 21st Show or give us a call at 800-222-9455. We got a tweet from Gibson in Champaign who says he felt relief when the Cubs clinched the pennant on Saturday night. He said, quote, "Being a Cubs fan is an exercise in waiting for when the other shoe drops, so it not dropping yet is such a liberating experience. To me, this World Series, especially with Schwarber, feels like a retrospective," end quote. And Schwarber, of course, Kyle Schwarber, Cubs player who was just added to the World Series roster after missing just about the entire season with an injury. As for me, I can pinpoint my Cubs fandom back to one particular date. September 5th, 1983, happened to be Labor Day. I was watching a Cubs game on television with my dad. He had the game on, and I kind of wandered in the room. I was 7 years old at the time. And the Cubs were playing in Montreal against the Expos, a pretty good team at the time. They had players like Andre Dawson, Tim Raines on the team. And the Cubs were leading 1-0 in the sixth inning. Steve Trout was the starting pitcher. He loaded the bases, and the Cubs brought in a journeyman relief pitcher named Mike Proley. And Mike Proley proceeded to strike out the first two batters he faced. And then Al Oliver came to the plate and hit a grand slam off of Mike Proley, and the Montreal Expos went on to win that game. That was my introduction to Cubs fandom. I would be rewarded a bit the next season with their 1984 playoff run. But if you've got a story to share, please do so right now. Tweet us at 21st Show or give us a call at 800-222-9455. We also received a voicemail from Steve. He's from the south side of Chicago. Let's take a listen.
I've been a Cubs fan since 1963. I was actually a Sox fan until I was 10 years old. Then I saw the light and switched over. I'm a Southside Cub fan. My license plates are SSCBF, Southside Cub fan. My heart's been broken since 1969 when I was 16 years old. And all we have is four more games to win. And hallelujah, the Cubs are on their way.
Yes, indeed. They're on their way. They're playing in their first World Series since 1945 tonight. And now let's go to the phone lines. We bring in Meg Welter and her grandma, Janet Jaster. Janet's on the phone with us from Chicago today. Janet, thanks for being with us this morning.
Sure. Okay.
Can you tell us how long you've been waiting for this day to see the Cubs playing in the World Series?
Well, I'm 78 years old, and I've waited since I was 10 years old. So 68 years.
Oh, wow. That's incredible.
Yep. That's a long time.
Yes, it is indeed. What's your what's your first Cubs memory?
Oh, my first Cubs memory is, it's so long ago I can't remember.
What are some things you remember about the Cubs, you know, from your childhood?
From my childhood. Well, I always had to listen to the games. I couldn't go to most of them, but I always, when I was a patrol girl at school, we got to get to go to the game, which was really, really fun for us. And that's about it.
So, you know, being a fan for 68 years, I'm sure you remember some of the, you know, the great players in the 1950s and 60s, Ernie Banks, Billy Williams,
yeah.
Ron Santo.
Oh, yes, yes. Bron Santo, Ernie Banks, Billy Williams. Right now I can't think of some more.
That's okay. There were some great players back in those days. Meg, I'd like to bring you in here. You tweeted at us yesterday saying that you and your grandma cried when the Cubs won the National League pennant on Saturday. What was that moment like for you, Meg?
Well, you know, it's... like that that tweet that you talked about a minute ago, being a Cubs fan is really an exercise in waiting for the other shoe to drop. Like, I was out for lunch earlier that day and the waiter was wearing a Cubs shirt and I was like, oh, hey, you know, are you pumped for tonight? And he was like, yeah, but I'm like super nervous because it's like we've gotten this far before, and it's, you know, in 2003 it was a total mess, and it was just I'm still in shock a little bit. I still can't believe that this is happening tonight, that the Cubs are playing in the World Series. It's incredible.
And what was it like for you, Meg, to be able to share that moment with your grandma?
We weren't actually in the same place. I called her after the game was over, but yeah, it was. You know, it was really amazing because, I mean, I'm a Cubs fan because of her. My dad is a White Sox fan and he's always asking where he went wrong. I have memories of being over there when I was really little and her always having the game on the radio and I would just listen. And so I don't even remember, you know, when my first encounter with the Cubs was. It's just been as far back as I can remember.
And Janet, I'd like to bring you back in here. What are you planning to do for the game tonight and for the rest of the World Series?
Well, I can only sit and watch it on the TV and hope and pray that they win.
Yeah, and Meg, I assume you'll be doing the same. You're going out anywhere to watch the game, or are you just going to watch it at home?
You know, I'm not sure. Tonight, I'll probably just be at home, maybe actually at work for a little while. Because, I mean, not a lot of my friends are sports fans, unfortunately. I'm kind of the odd one out. But I usually listen to it because I just have a lot of affection for the Cubs radio broadcasters. And I just love the way they call the game, you know, Pat Hughes. So sometimes I prefer to listen over watch, actually.
And Janet, how about you? Do you prefer to listen or watch them on TV?
Oh, I prefer to watch them on TV.
Okay, all right.
I love to watch them.
Yeah, it should be a great experience. Meg Welter, Janet Jaster, thanks so much for joining us today on the 21st and sharing your fan experience.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
You're quite welcome. Many Cubs fans watching home games on TV in recent years have noticed one man in particular sitting behind home plate. His real name is Jim Anixter, but he's better known as Pink Hat Guy among Cubs fans. That's quite literally for the pink hat he's worn to games at Wrigley Field since the 1990s, and Jim Anixter joins us on the phone right now. Jim, thanks for joining us today.
It's my pleasure, and I'm very excited. If someone would have told me that I was born in 1944 and I'd be 71 years between pennants and that they'd clinch a pennant on my birthday this past Saturday, I'd say, what are you smoking? It was my birthday.
Yeah, I was going to say, could you imagine a better birthday present than the Cubs winning the pennant for you?
No, as I said, it's almost as good as my honeymoon, maybe better, you know.
What was that moment like for you on Saturday when the Cubs got that game-ending double play to clinch the pennant?
Yeah, it was a major relief because I've been a diehard Cubs fan all my life. I go back to the 50s when they had Handsome Ransom Jackson at third, Roy Smalley at short, Eddie Mix at second, Dee Fondi at first, Harry Chidi behind the plate, and outfield Hank Sauer in left, Frankie Baumholtz in the center, and Ralph Kiner in right. And then my major team that I feel very badly about, they didn't win anything, but they were darn good, was the 69 Cubs. And the Cubs, the years DeRocher had a team from 67 to 72. And I was there for the Bartman thing, and I said, thank God we got this behind us.
Oh yeah, absolutely. You mentioned those that Cubs team in the 50s that was kind of the lineup when you first started becoming a fan. Can you pinpoint it back to your first game or your first moment where the Cubs really grabbed you as a fan?
Well, as I said, I it was something for me to do, and I came from a very interesting family, analytical at that. So the Cubs were a good outlet, and I used to skip school and take the train to Davis Street L, and then go right to the ballpark with some buddies, sometimes by myself, and sit in the bleachers wherever I could get a seat. And that was the story. Then in 1966, I got discharged from active duty. I was on a military veteran. I was the U.S. Coast Guard. And I walked in Wrigley Field, and I sat like I haven't done the season in the first row of my company. The guy said, "You're nuts." All of a sudden, I'm walking out the door. He said, "If you don't like sitting behind home plate, I got these 6 seats for you." I'm okay. And then 1981, Sears Roebuck had a corporate cutback. The Cubs called us. And they said, "Would you like another 6 seats across the aisle?" I said, "Fine." And then when Sam Zell, a prominent Chicago, bought my former company, I took the 12 seats with me. Then 2004, I get a call. Mr. Anixter, we're putting 3 rows in front of ABC and D, and I wasn't overly happy about it, but a gentleman I'm sure you heard of by the name of Billy Williams, who worked for me a number of years, I worked it out with the Cubs and us. So we have 4 seats in row A and 12 seats in row one, which is really row five because it says row one, but it's confusing the customers. I have to tell them it's really row five. There's ABC and D in front of it.
Wow. So from that vantage point, right behind home plate, what's it been like for you just to watch the ups and downs, the ebbs and flows of the Chicago Cubs for so long?
Well, it's just kind of heartbreaking in a sense. Opening day 69 was great. And on the 11th inning, the Cubs are losing 5-4 and a 1-2 count. The Rocher munches to the bench, and out comes Willie Smith hitting for Jim Hickman on a 1-2 count, 1-on-1 out. He hits a home run to Sheffield Avenue, and the Cubs won 6-5. They won 10 straight to start the year, and it was great. And Ernie Banks had 2 home runs that day, and no one talked about it. But that was exciting. Getting back to the Bartman thing, it wasn't his fault. I mean, everyone points to him, but the next guy hit a double play ball to Alex Gonzalez, which he kicked. So,
yeah,
went through his legs. So it really was his fault. Bartman spared him a lot of bad wrath, let me put it to you that way. Now that the Cubs, the monkey's off the Cubs' back, they won the pennant. If they don't win the World Series, I'll be disappointed, but I won't be literally upset because they got the monkey off their back and they got the goat behind us and all that stuff.
Tell us a little bit about what you're looking forward to this weekend with games 3, 4, and maybe game 5 being played at Wrigley Field.
Well, what I'm looking forward to is taking my 5-month-old grandson. I have grandsons 18, 17, 15, and 5 months. I was born in 1944, and I used to ask my late father and uncle when I was older, like a bratty kid, why'd you guys take me to the World Series, blah, blah, blah. They said, listen, little so-and-so. We just got back fighting the Germans and Japanese, so you could go to Wrigleyville. I thought that was a good answer. But now I'm taking my 5-month-old grandson to Friday's game. I'm going to take pictures. If you're under the age of 2, they get it for nothing. He's going to sit on my lap, and we already made out a hat for him, called a little pink hat guy in a green outfit, and he's going to sit in my lap, and we're going to take pictures. So he can say years later, he was at the Cubs for its World Series in a long time, since 45.
Awesome. We have to ask you, Jim, you're known as the pink hat guy. Where does the pink hat come from, and why do you wear it every game?
Well, it came from 1990. The All-Star Game was at Wrigley Field. And the day before was the home run hitting contest, which Ryan Sandberg, who's currently with the Cubs, won that day, and they passed out pink hats. My wife, who wasn't a huge baseball fan, didn't really care for that, baseball. So what I was doing was wearing a pink hat and a green shirt because the green goes with the ivy, and and green grass and so forth. And then later on, a few years later, about 10 years later, my cousin Jeffrey Annenberg said, Why don't you make a hat called the Pink Hat Guy, and it's trademarked and everything by a patent attorney of mine. And what I do with the hat now, I wear the hat, and anybody wants one around the country, I give it to them free if they make a donation to the American Cancer Society or cancer charity of choice. I lost a lot of friends to cancer. My brother died of cancer at age 58. My tennis partner, who I used to play tennis with, died of pancreatic cancer. So at least in a small way, I'm trying to give back to the community.
And if anyone listening here is maybe interested in learning more, Jim, do you have a website or a way to get in touch?
Yeah, they can email me at smalljannixter in small letters with the small ad sign, smalla-industries.com. Or you can go to YouTube and punch up the Pink Cat Guy at Wrigley Field. I'm up to over 9,000 hits. I started when I was 61. Now I'm 72. I just keep on getting hits. And I'm a one-man band. I'm trying to work out something with the Cub Charities where they can take it over. It's not a question of the financial thing. I'm a one-man band. I don't have a cast of thousands working. I do it myself.
Sure. Well, Jim Anixter, Pink Hat Guy, thanks so much for joining us today on the 21st. We look forward to seeing you right behind home plate in Game 3.
Oh, as I said, I'm so excited. I honestly think they have a real good chance of beating Cleveland. And be great. And if they win the World Series, it'll be bigger than the 85 Bears, the 6 Bulls championships, the 3 Stanley Cups, and the White Sox World Series. Right now, it's the greatest thing in sports. If they should be frosting in the cape and win the World Series, it'll be the greatest thing in the history of all sports.
Absolutely. Jim, thanks so much for being with us here today. Jim Anixter, the Pink Hat Guy, joining us today on the 21st. Meanwhile, many Cubs fans are familiar with the name Steve Goodman. He might be best known for writing the song played at Wrigley Field after every Cubs win, Go Cubs Go. But he also wrote a darkly humorous song while he himself was battling leukemia called A Dying Cubs Fan's Last Request. Steve Goodman died in 1984 at the age of 36, 11 days before the Cubs played their first playoff game since 1945. Here's just a taste of it. You're listening to The 21st.
Do they still play the blues in Chicago when baseball season rolls around? When the snow melts away, do the Cubbies still play in their ivy-covered burial ground? When I was a boy, they were my pride and joy, but now they only bring fatigue to the home of the brave, the land of the free, and the doormat of the National League. He told his friends, you know the law of averages says anything will happen that can. That's what it says. But the last time the Cubs won a National League pennant was the year we dropped the bomb on Japan. The Cubs made me a criminal, sent me down a wayward path. They stole my youth from me, that's the truth. I'd forsake my teachers to go sit in the bleachers in flagrant truancy. And then one thing led to another, and soon I discovered alcohol, gambling, dope, football, hockey, lacrosse, tennis. But what do you expect when you raise up a young boy's hopes and then just crush them like so many paper beer cups, year after 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 year, till those hopes are just so much popcorn for the pigeons beneath the L tracks to eat. He said, you know,
the late Steve Goodman with his song, A Dying Cubs Fan's Last Request. You're listening to The 21st. Stay tuned. Coming up in just a moment, we'll hear from Cubs author and historian George Castle. He covered the team for about 20 years as a reporter in Northwest Indiana. He's written several books about the Cubs. We'll delve into the Cubs' history with George Castle coming up next. You're listening to The 21st. We've been talking about the Chicago Cubs' first trip to the World Series in 71 years all morning, but now it's time to delve into some of the team's history that makes this year so special. We're bringing in author and former Cubs reporter George Castle into the conversation. He's written books such as The Million to One Team and Entangled in Ivy, and he's on the phone with us right now. George, thanks for joining us on the 21st.
Well, thanks for having me, Brian, and we are in uncharted territory here because how many of us were alive when the Cubs last made a World Series? That is so odds-defying to go 7 decades without doing so.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of your books really gets into that, The Million to One Team. You got that title from a Vegas odds maker, and it really kind of captures, I think, what many fans have always felt about the Cubs and the long odds against them doing what they've done. Did you ever think you'd be able to see them get back to the World Series?
Yeah, it would have required good management and a good dollop of good luck. And just to tell you where that million to one thing came from, the story, I was in Vegas to interview Greg Maddux at his home after he defected from the Cubs as a free agent, which was the biggest botch job by Cubs management in history. So while I was in Vegas, Brian, I happened to ask John Avello, who was a top Vegas odds maker then and now, what were the odds of the Cubs avoiding a World Series since 1945? If he had been an odds maker in 1945, you told him the Cubs would not make a World Series for the next 47 years. What would be the odds? He said they'd be astronomical, off the charts. They'd be a million to one. And certainly moves like letting Maddux go, the team developing the Ace of Aces, feed into those odds. And I want to point out to you, you now advance the clock another 23 years, another full generation. What would the odds be? A million and a half to one? 2 million to one? It just doesn't compute. And I'll tell you why the odds are so astronomical. 14 expansion teams came into baseball since 1961. Only two of them failed to make the World Series. And four expansion teams, the Royals, the Blue Jays, the Mets, and there's one other team. It escapes my mind here.
The Marlins, I think.
They won two World Series. And it just doesn't make sense. Yeah, the majority of the time the Cubs were grossly mismanaged, but then in 1984 and 2003, they were one game away with three chances to get into the World Series, and they lost all three games. To me, that's on the players with a little bit of the manager's fault and a dollop of bad luck.
Yeah, and I'd like to kind of delve into some of the franchise's history with you a little bit. Certainly, the Cubs were a successful franchise through much of the early 20th century. They won 11 National League pennants through 1945. What changed in the team's ownership and management that caused their ineptitude in the years that followed 1945?
Well, you have to go back into the middle of their success reaching the World Series. Now, again, they appeared in five World Series between 1929 and 1945. The first four were on an every three-year schedule, 29, 32, 35, and 38. What changed was the premature death of William L. Veeck as Cubs president in 1933. He's the father of the famous baseball Barnum Bill Veeck. But William L. Veeck, and I rated him in my latest book, Baseball Game Changers, as one of the top 50 impactful people or events that have changed the game. Because William L. Veeck not only built the Cubs into a powerhouse, the National League equivalent of the Babe Ruth New York Yankees, but he also brought in innovations like season tickets, blanket radio coverage of the games, selling tickets outside the ballpark, ladies' days that increased the number of female fans. He was the most dynamic executive in the game. But when he contracted leukemia in 1933, there was nothing the doctors of the time could do for him. He died unable to train his son to replace him, and that forced then-Cubs owner P.K. Wrigley, the second Wrigley who owned the franchise, he was not a baseball fan, and said to reporters in 1934 he didn't know anything about baseball. But here's the catch, Brian. Those reporters liked P.K. Wrigley. He was a shy man but also personal one-on-one. You could call him up at his Wrigley building office or at his estate in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. He was accessible. So the reporters covered for him, and they told Wrigley they would not repeat what he said, that he didn't know anything about baseball. Despairing over not being able to find another William Veeck to run the team on his behalf, Wrigley appointed himself president, and his harebrained schemes, running the team and meddling, an inability to find a capable baseball executive who could run the Cubs on a day-to-day basis, consigned the team to mediocrity and worse. The main thing, and this was admitted by everybody involved in the Cubs organization by the 1950s, was failure to develop a quality farm system at a time when Branch Rickey, pioneered the farm system first with the Cardinals and then the Brooklyn Dodgers. The Cubs, when they finally had a farm system in the 40s, were still far behind the Cardinals and Dodgers, who were the mainstay teams of the National League, the winningest teams, and Wrigley failed to properly fund it and have the right people running it.
After more than two decades of some pretty bad baseball on Chicago's north side, the 1969 season, of course, one of the most famous in Cubs history, with a team that was in first place in their division for most of the year. How was that team built, and why did they ultimately come up short to the Mets that year?
Well, the team was built partially through homegrown players. There was an uptick in the Cubs' homegrown situation. Billy Williams and Ron Sano were developed out of the Cub farm system in 1960 and 61. Ernie Banks, of course, signed from the Negro Leagues. Don Kissinger came out of the Cubs farm system, and so did Ken Holtzman, a University of Illinois product. Mm-hmm. Ken Holtzman was drafted out of the University of Illinois in the very first draft in 1965, or fourth round. There were some rare, astute trades by then general manager John Holland, who was quite an underqualified guy running the team, but he was a Wrigley acolyte, very slavishly loyal to Wrigley. And it all came together under manager Leo Durocher, who was dynamic in reviving the Cubs from a 103-loss team in 1966 to an 87-win team and a contender in 67. However, Leo Durocher did not trust his bench players. He had too much confidence and an old-fashioned idea about his regulars. And he played his regulars every single day into the ground. Randy Hunley caught 151 games, including doubleheaders. Ron Sano, who had juvenile diabetes, type 1 diabetes. In those days, you couldn't measure your blood sugar with glucometers, and you could only guess what your blood sugar level was. Sano would have a candy bar or a can of soda in the dugout to get an injection of sugar if he felt faint. He played all those day games, Sano, without being able to accurately measure his blood sugar. It's an amazing feat unto itself. So by Durocher not resting his regulars down the stretch, that team tired out. He was going up. Durocher was basically a 1930s vintage manager going up against a 1970s manager in the Mets, Gil Hodges, one of the first guys to use a five-man pitching rotation. So Ron Swoboda, who was a Mets outfielder at the time, told me several decades later, the Cubs had the big guns, but we had many more weapons. And simply by numbers, the Mets wore the Cubs down, and a 10-game lead over the Mets on August 13th melted away. Eventually, at the season's end, the Cubs finished 8 games behind the Mets, an 18-game swing in a month and a half.
And, you know, despite being competitive for a couple more years after 1969, the team never really contended again for a playoff spot after 69. What happened there?
Well, they had a very poor farm system. They could not bring up quality players, and there was behind-the-scenes racism, too. They had Buck O'Neill, one of the great baseball minds in history. Buck's made the Hall of Fame. And the Cubs assigned him to scout the black schools in the South, colleges and universities. But in the first 16 years of the amateur draft starting in 1965, the Cubs did not select an African-American in those first 16 years, despite Buck O'Neill coming up with a great collection of talent. He was responsible for bringing Ernie Banks over from the Kansas City Monarchs, later George Altman and Lou Johnson. The only significant African-American player he didn't originally sign was Billy Williams, but he also got Lou Brock, Oscar Gamble, Joe Carter. So you can see the quality of players that he got, but the Cubs never took Buck O'Neill's recommendations to heart, and there was a lot of behind-the-scenes conservative behavior where if an African-American player had a relationship outside his race, if he was found dating white girls, he was quickly traded, as Oscar Gamble was in 1969. He was their top outfield prospect. So you had some behind-the-scenes racism going on with the Cubs, and the Chicago media did not report it. I blame Mike Royko, the great columnist of the Chicago Daily News, who played the Cubs for laughs, and he was the only man in Chicago who had taken on the original Mayor Richard J. Daley for things that bad policies the Daily did. He was the only one who had the clout to have exposed Wrigley and John Holland for running such a slipshod organization.
Yeah, finally, then in 1984, the Cubs are able to get back to the playoffs for the first time since 1945. As someone who covered that team on a daily basis, when did you know that the Cubs actually had a chance to be a contender?
Well, probably early in the season when the lineup coalesced. They were much more competitive than they had been in the previous few years. Some really dreadful Cubs teams that Dallas Green, the Cubs general manager and Tribune Company, inherited by the last from the last Wrigley to own the team, William Wrigley Jr. Dallas Green had struck gold with some trades, veteran players that panned out. And once he got Rick Sutcliffe and Dennis Eckersley in the middle of the season, the Cubs pitching enabled them to take off, and they were able to overhaul the Mets in August and win the National League East.
Of course, Cubs fans know very well how that season ended with a heartbreaking loss to the San Diego Padres. You know, they popped up with a couple of other playoff berths in 1989 and 1998. But really, the next time the Cubs were in what you would call prime position for a World Series berth was in 2003. And I think all fans remember that NLCS with Steve Bartman reaching for a foul ball, Alex Gonzalez booting a double play grounder, and the wheels coming off. How did that National League Championship Series in 2003 fit into the Cubs' history of disappointment?
Well, it was catastrophic. The most catastrophic on-the-field incident in Cubs' history, let's say in 1929, Hack Wilson dropped a fly ball in the sun or lost two fly balls in the sun in the World Series, and the Cubs, but at least the Cubs were in the World Series. This one, five outs away from the World Series, I remember writing my lead for the Times of Northwest Indiana based on Mark Pryor with the lightning coming out of his arm, striking dead the ghosts of Cubs history, and suddenly, just in literally the snap of a fingers, the Marlins scored eight runs. But I recreated that scene for Entangled in Ivy, and I talked to everybody involved in that play, and everybody said Mark Pryor was dealing at the time that that foul ball was hit. The issue that was, though, that Mark Pryor was only in his first full year as a major league pitcher. And you always err on the side of a caution with a young player.
Yeah, absolutely. Bullpen usage has changed quite a bit. After some uneven years there with Jim Hendry leading baseball operations for the Cubs, they got some new ownership in Tom Ricketts, a new management led by Theo Epstein. As someone who has seen so much disappointment over the years, how confident were you that this group could be the ones to finally get the Cubs back to the World Series?
If you're talking about a rebuild, the Cubs did do it right from the baseball operations standpoint, and not just getting bad to get good. The Cubs' main problem with their farm system is inability to produce position players. So the Cubs had a very good strategy to pick the likes of Chris Bryant and Kyle Schwarber, number one. And they got lucky. Those guys did not have a long transition period of struggling in the majors. They were both instant successes. Plus, in trades, they picked up position players like Anthony Rizzo and Addison Russell. Then, most recently, they've gotten tremendous, tremendous input from the Javier Baez's and Wilson Contreras's. They've been so spectacular and so aggressive. Joe Maddon has to play these young players in the playoffs, and they've been the Cubs' biggest producers.
George Castle, longtime Cubs reporter and author. He's written books such as The Million to One Team and Entangled in Ivy. George, thank you very much for your time and perspective today.
Glad to give you a little Cubs history perspective. We could go literally hours on this, and we wouldn't complete the whole story, would we, Brian?
Indeed, but that's all the time we have for today. The Cubs face the Cleveland Indians tonight in Game 1 of the World Series. Here's the Chicago Symphony Orchestra with a little baseball music to take us out. We're produced by Hala Delahi, Christine Herman, and Sean Newman. Technical direction comes from Jason Croft with help today from Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our news director. I'm Brian Moline, sitting in for Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.